Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
What does Colgate mean by live life to the brightest? Could it be a rich glass of red sipped inside a Parisian cafe on a snowy night when my gaze is met by a tall, mysterious... I mean, brushing is directed with Colgate Optic White Pro Series Toothpaste gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 3 days, so you can live life to the brightest and finish that glass without worrying about teeth stains. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
You're listening to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, taking you behind the scenes with the stars and creators of the biggest shows on Broadway and beyond. I'm your host, Variety's theater editor, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'll be talking to actress Gillian Jacobs and Thomas Kail, the director of Hamilton, about their new off-Broadway play, Kings, now playing at the Public Theater. The timely play, an examination of money, politics, and Washington lobbyists, is the latest by Sarah Burgess, whose equally topical first play, Wall Street Story Dry Powder, was directed by Kail at the Public in 2016. For Jacobs, who's familiar to TV viewers from shows like Community and Netflix's Love, Kings marks her first New York stage appearance since she was in the cast of Stephen Adley Girgis's The Little Flower of East Orange in 2008. They're both in the studio with me to talk theater, politics, money, and more. Gillian and Tommy, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Happy to be here.
So politics and the ins and out of what happens in Washington have obviously been front and center in the American consciousness for the last couple of years now. And I feel like Kings takes what feels like a particularly relevant look at the ethical questions that rise from the role that money plays in the workings of Washington. Gillian, tell us about your character and the issues that she's confronting in the play.
I play Kate, who is a lobbyist who works in healthcare policy, and at the beginning of the play, we meet her at a retreat in Vail, where she is trying to convince a new congresswoman to get on board with a bill she has that will benefit podiatrists. Mm-hmm. And we see her at work in the first scene. And over the course of the play, she's going to start to maybe question for the first time her job, its importance, and what effect it's having on American politics and American life.
Is that a real convention?
Yes. So there are all of these retreats around the country that
the s'mores event sounds really fun.
Yes, yeah. I know. I think the play, the origin of the play was an article that the playwright Sarah Burgess read about these retreats that lawmakers and lobbyists and donors go on that apparently they don't like to talk about very much publicly. And she was just fascinated by this idea. And so, yeah, we see one later in the play that's happening at Disney World. And so there are these gatherings of people who are really shaping American law and policy. And, people like my character are paying to attend this, paying this congresswoman's campaign committee to fly out there. And so I was not really aware of these before working on the play, but I think they're important to talk about.
Yeah. And so, Tommy, what did you feel like were the big issues you grappled with as you were directing the play about politics in Washington and all the ethical issues that come up?
I think trying to represent humanity and human beings who are caught up in this, who have made a decision, and like anything else that you're trying to put on stage, think very deeply about why these days, why these moments, like what's bringing us to this particular intersection of these characters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that Sarah and I both grew up outside of Washington, D.C., in the same town, although I'm 112 years older than her. I think that, at least for my own point of view with Washington, being sort of on the outside...
Where are we from?
I'm from Alexandria, Virginia, yeah. Which is about, yeah, you know, just a few miles outside. But but no one goes from D.C. to Virginia. It's like living in New Jersey. You know, like we're, you, right. I lived in New Jersey for a little while, right. and people would say, well, we can't go there. I said, you know, it's the same distance for me to come in. no one really seemed to care. And so being an outsider in this very inside culture is something that Sarah's also exploring, both with the congressperson played by Issa Davis, mm-hmm. who is someone who wins a special election in Texas, and then all of a sudden is thrust into this. And then you have people that...
has these ideals in conflict with the way the system works.
Yeah, perhaps informed by not being part of the system. Right. And obviously Potomac Fever and a lot of, you know, those ideas are things that you grow up close to Washington, you hear about. But I sort of ran away from politics. Usually if you grew up in an area like I did, you either go right in or you go away. And I went the opposite direction and then have spent the last few years of my life running political campaigns that just happened to be shows.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because actually that Hamilton show is moderately political as well.
apparently.
Yeah.
We thought we had a funny story about a guy who was in government, but we were wrong.
Right.
Trying to make a rip-snorting comedy to impress Gillian. But it did not.
And how...
Still may.
Yeah. And how soon after Dry Powder did you start working on this?
Well, Sarah
did
was
she start working on
Sarah
it?
Was writing this concurrently. Involved? So when we were in production for Dry Powder, she was working on early drafts of this play. So that's about almost exactly 2 years ago.
Okay, yeah.
And so it was written over a period of time where the world changed and landscape shifted. And yet the core ideas of this play, what does it mean to have power? What does it mean to try to get power? And how do you get things that you want from other people, are also really distilled theatrical ideas. I mean, that's where comedy and drama comes from, that kind of conflict.
And then, Gillian, how did you get involved?
I think a year ago, I did a reading of the...
But it feels like 11 months.
Feels like 11 months.
I finally made her laugh 7 weeks. 7 weeks in.
Is she a tough laugh? Is that...
Are you kidding me? I can't... This is the first time she's been moderately impressed by me.
We'll see. I did a reading of an earlier draft of this play 12 or 11 months ago.
Right.
And
how did it... Did you know the writer? Did you know Tommy? Did you know the public?
Met,
I mean, you'd worked with the public.
Tommy and I had met.
Okay. Yeah.
I did not know Sarah. I had read Dry Powder.
Okay.
I had wanted to audition for Dry Powder, but I couldn't because it conflicted with the shooting schedule on my TV show. But...
When would that have been? That would have been Love, or that
yes,
would have been... Yeah,
Love.
Okay.
Yeah.
Season one of Love?
Perhaps, or maybe two.
Mm.
Who's to know?
Oh, Netflix. Season three coming out soon.
Season three coming out soon. We'll be talking about that soon, too.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was definitely aware of Sarah as a writer. I really liked her writing. And then I thought that this play was excellent, and I really loved this character of Kate. I thought, for me personally, it was a great character and a departure from what I'd done recently.
Okay, yeah. Can you expand a little bit on why you thought it was a great character?
So, you know, I was excited by the prospect of working on a play that was about ideas and all these questions of power and how do you get it, and not so much focused on, like, the romantic life of my character or, you know, I've done a lot of things recently that have had, you know, I did this movie for Netflix that's like a great rom-com, and Love is obviously about love.
That's called, is that Ibiza? Is that,
yes, yeah, okay. It'll come out this year. So I'd done a lot of things recently that centered around romantic relationships, and so I was really drawn to the idea of working on something that was not about that, that was about people fighting about ideas and ideals.
Sorry, I just almost fell
over. Tommy
out of my
almost
chair.
Fell over. But
I thought you were trying to see if these were real drawers.
I was so bored by listening to him. Sorry.
Wow,
center of gravity.
Stay down.
He
all
said
right.
Lightly edited,
take
right?
The director,
back my pity
the director
laugh
speaks.
From earlier.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I think for me, selfishly, this was a, you know, an exciting departure from what I'd done recently.
Were you looking to come back to theater? How long has it been since you've done a play?
It's been 10 years exactly, and it was at the Public Theater.
That was the last one, Little
yes,
Flower?
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
So I did this play called The Little Flower of East Orange by Stephen Ali Girgis 10 years ago at the Public Theater. And so I think around the time that I read Dry Powder was when I really started to think about, like, maybe I would like to do a play again. And I'd done little one-day things in L.A., like the 24-hour play festival or this Shakespeare benefit that Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson do, where I got to play all my dream roles in Shakespeare for a day. And so I'd had little bits of it, but nothing like being in a rehearsal process and, you know, doing a full run of a show. So by the time this reading came around, it really felt to me like something that would be great to do.
And Tommy, this physical production looks fairly similar to Dry Powder in a way. Can you tell me tell us a little bit about kind of what the play looks like and what it does to have it staged in the way that you have staged it with audience on either side?
Sure. I kept on waiting for Gillian to talk about the role of the director and her decisions, yeah. But
irrelevant.
Well, that's for episode 21 of Stagecraft.
That's correct.
So this is going to be a two-parter.
To be continued.
Yeah, I didn't know that you were aware of this, Gordon, but I've got a lot of free time today.
I don't.
She's so busy. She's on Love on Netflix. Congrats.
So
Sarah, whether she knows it or not, is in the midst of writing a trilogy. And I think she's writing a trilogy about the dynamics of power and how you can be corrupted by power and how you try to hold on to your value. So Dry Powder was the first offering in that.
And what's number three?
Exactly.
Okay.
It's about three people in a podcast that goes really awry. And so what I found in making Dry Powder, because it was about the world of high finance, which is a relatively hidden world, which is something that Sarah was really interested in, this is something that's actually intentionally kept opaque and behind closed doors. So to expose it and try to make it feel like it was relevant and not something that was so distant from who we are, I staged the show in the round with very suggestive, representational furniture, right? Like a cube was
everything,
whatever you wanted
multiple
it to be.
Ways.
That's
yeah,
right.
Exactly.
And also, you know, in a sort of practical way, you know, when you're trying to be smart about things like budgets, and Sarah writes a play where it takes place in an office building where the chair probably costs $57,000. Right. I knew what my entire budget was, and it didn't feel like we were going to get that chair. Right. And so what I thought was, let's just do something that's evocative that keeps the focus on the language and the actors. And then in doing this play, which is 12 distinct scenes in 8 different locations over 96 minutes, which is a real thrill for a director. You know, it also gave me a chance to try to explore in a way that felt like it was a relative of what we'd done before, but not go back and take out the same playbook. So here the audience is on two sides.
Right.
So alley style is what they call that.
Right, yeah.
And I think it does give you that kind of proximity, but there's also the opportunity to watch the audience watch the show. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about the nature of how politics has created this kind of arena feel. And if you watch any town hall or debate, so much of it is about that kind of interaction. There happened to be a scene in the middle of our show, which is that, which felt like we could kind of build from there. And then there's a lot of thoughts thematically that Ana Luisos, our wonderful set designer, and I started kicking around about the recycled nature and the cyclical nature of so many of these conversations. How many times do you say the same thing to a different Congress person? That
and all the hotel lobbies look exactly the
same.
Right.
And if you have and if you're in like a business class hotel, they basically like hose it down and bring in the next person who has like a slightly different suitcase.
Right.
So how do you evoke that and keep it moving? And also because there's real propulsion to this play and the way that the characters speak and think, I wanted to allow our show to support that and not get in the way. So it wasn't a show about transitions. It was a show about trying to get to the next place. And the next place looks very familiar to the place you just were. And I think that also can have an impact, hopefully, on the audience experience of understanding the sort of rat race of it.
Yeah. This is probably the most important question I have, which involves these two scenes happen in Chili's, right? Explain to me the research you did into Chili's and in particular into their margaritas.
I don't drink, so I've never had a margarita.
There's a lot of Gatorade on stage.
Yeah,
I was going to say, what is that green stuff?
I heartily gulp the margarita, and I did think last night, does someone drink a margarita like this? And like, because I get so thirsty because our characters talk so much that I really relish the opportunity to be able to drink anything on stage. And as I was gulping the margarita last night, I thought, what message is this sending about my character? But I need...
It seemed in character.
I need the hydration. I am realizing as we are doing interviews, I'm a very lazy actor. I don't know that I've ever been to Chili's. And I did no research. But my character starts out with quite a bit of disdain for Chili's. So that feels right.
Mm-hmm, right.
Because you hate the things you don't know? Is that what you're saying, Gillian?
No, but I shouldn't have like a... I don't have to come onto stage with a deep love and affection for Chili's because my character doesn't. Okay, Tommy?
I think that's right. And she probably hates
continues.
It without having been, right?
Yeah.
She's
a snob. And but now I think we have to go to Chili's.
I think the
I'm actually surprised that hasn't happened yet, honestly.
It's harder to find a Chili's in New York City than you'd
Well,
think.
That's actually true. Yeah.
Although we could probably go to JFK and go to a Chili's too. T-O-O. Hashtag plug Chili's. But, you know, the thing about the nature of Washington is there's there's so few places you can actually go to have a private conversation. And what we have in the Chili's moments, there's three scenes throughout the show, is Issa's character, who is from a place that takes great pride in the fact that Chili's is in this expansion world and started as just one single restaurant. And that's a place where you can go. And again, to my earlier point, I didn't know why I was saying it then, but now I do, is no one goes 8 miles outside of Washington. You might as well be, you know, in Alaska. And so that's a place where these two characters can have a relatively private conversation outside of the gaze and the glare of your cohorts.
Right. So, Gillian, you've worked with two big names in comedy lately, both Dan Harmon and Judd Apatow. And Tommy Kail. I'm sorry, three. And Thomas Kail. Do you consider yourself a comic actor? Are you a comedian? Or how do you think of yourself as a performer?
Well, I guess I think of myself as an actor who's done a lot of comedy.
Okay.
I don't have any training in comedy specifically. I didn't go to UCB or Second City or Groundlings.
You went to Juilliard, right?
Yes.
You studied acting at Juilliard. Yeah.
Kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
Similar.
Except for they hate improv there.
Can't sketch.
Yeah. So it was a funny thing for me because I was trained in this environment where the text was sacred. You're word perfect or you are a failure. And then I go and work on, comedies where you're expected to improvise. And so it took some adjusting for me, but I was really lucky to work on Community because the cast was so incredibly talented and we would spend so long shooting the scenes that I really got to just basically learn from them how to improvise. And I would read a script and I would get nervous because if they gave me a physical bit or something, I wasn't quite sure how I could do it or how I was supposed to make that funny. And so I would read the scripts and then I would see the actors bring those things to life with their parts. And so I sort of just would steal from Donald Glover and Jim Rash and all these people. And so I feel like I've developed skills in that area, but it's not something that I set out to do.
And then, so does any of that sort of your experience with improv and comedy figure into now as you're coming back on stage? Can you feel that figuring
well,
into how you
Tommy,
work?
Well, Tommy, going back to our favorite place, Chili's, Tommy likes to point out...
I was hoping you'd bring this up.
Yeah, what a ham sandwich I am in the first Chili's scene where I really make a meal of eating the fajita. And so, yes.
The sizzling fajitas are a big deal in this play, we should say.
I have more of those instincts now than I did 10 years ago when I was doing The Little Flower.
Right.
But I try to approach each thing individually for what it is and not feel this obligation. I mean, the writing is funny. That's the thing. Sarah's writing is funny, so you just basically have to say the lines.
Right.
You don't have to do much more than that. But, yeah, I guess it does give you a different degree of confidence that it's like, I've been working on this for the last 9 years, so I'm not as afraid of comedy and a script as I would have been.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so, Tommy, you're starting to branch out and do some screen stuff as well. You did Grease Live.
Gulp.
Yeah.
Why I wanna.
You're working on some TV shows too. Tell us about what's coming up for you on
What's coming up for me is preview number 16.
Of
Kings
course.
Tonight at the Public Theater.
Yeah.
I have this little production company that I started to develop television for Fox. And coming out of the experience of Grease Live, which was a very positive one, where I got to take some of the limited skills I had here and marry them with some very smart people out there, it provided me a chance to build a little bit of a bridge from some of the people I knew to introduce them to some people out there. So watching William Ivy Long do a costume presentation for the president of Fox is like the greatest thing you can imagine. And of course, like in our world, William is William. And David Corns
needs
came in.
No introduction.
Yeah, and then you walk in there and they're like, who is this man in the khakis and the blue blazer? And he's like telling, I could probably do a whole podcast on it. And he's like, okay. Everyone over there, like, is ordering people around who haven't been told, what to do for, 63 years. And he's, having them, hold his props. And so I loved kind of crashing those things into each other.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm most interested in doing is trying to take some of the sensibility that I've cultivated and some of the people I know and see if we can just find a different place to tell those stories. But I hope to always work in the theater. I also don't see theater as the minor leagues for film and television.
Right.
And there's a conversation that sometimes happens out there. It's like, oh, well, now you've done this. Are you ready for this? Right. And that's not that's certainly not how anyone in our company feels about that, meaning like our acting company.
Right.
And so they are actors in the same way that I'm a director, and there'll be some stories that hopefully I get to tell in different places.
And the new and final season of your TV show Love is dropping next month.
Yes.
What can we expect from that?
What we can expect, probably some scenes of Mickey and Gus together. Mm-hmm. I think I can guarantee that. Yeah.
You are embarking on a relationship on for reals on a relationship. Right?
They're attempting to actually be in a relationship. I'm never really allowed to say anything or I get in big trouble.
Does it feel like the end of the story, I guess, was one of my questions.
Oh, well, you know, I don't ever know that is it ever the end or it's just where we say goodbye to them? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Jacob's coming for you.
But I'm excited for people to see it. It's been, you know, it's been really interesting to see how deeply these characters touch some people and like how they are both incredibly drawn to them and then also very angered by them and sometimes at the same time. So people have very strong reactions to the show. So it's been interesting to see, you know, as these three seasons have evolved. But yeah, it's gonna be goodbye for now to Mickey and Gus.
And you mentioned Ibiza, which is out later this year, right?
Yes.
On Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
And what else is coming up for you after?
Yes. I'm also in a movie called Life of the Party with Melissa McCarthy. Mm-hmm. And then what else do I have coming out?
We're doing a play every year for the next...
Yes. I'm currently in a play at the Public Theater.
That's what I hear.
That's what I hear. She's committed to do four plays a year, which is great. Thank you, Gillian.
Yeah.
Breaking news.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want theater to be a part of your career? Is that a thing that you...
Yeah. I mean, I was a child who had a subscription to American Theater Magazine. You know, I would read it cover to cover every month. I dragged my family to the George Bernard Shaw...
This was in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
Yeah.
I, like, remember reading... Betty's Summer Vacation, the Christopher Durang.
Yeah, the Christopher Durang. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember reading, because every month there would be a full-length play
in the middle.
Theater.
Sure.
Yes. So I remember reading, and I would, like, study the production photos, and then when I went to Juilliard, Chris Durang, you know, ran the playwriting program with Marsha Norman, and I was so starstruck by meeting Chris Durang. So, yeah, and I would drag my family to the George Bernard Shaw Festival in Niagara-on-the-Lake, Canada.
They must have
year.
Loved you a lot.
Oh, yeah. 5 years running. That was our summer vacation. I would see three plays a day.
Wow.
They would have a noon, a matinee, and an evening, and my family would maybe come to one of them. So, yeah, I didn't really find a lot of people at school who wanted to talk about Passion, Poison, and Petrification with me. But
but she has now.
Yeah. Still not. Jonesville's Other Island, anyone? Yes, The Simpleton of the Unexpected Isle, all wonderful Shaw plays I saw as a child.
Wow.
So,
so she's the real thing. Okay, I don't know if anyone out there was wondering if Gillian Jacobs knows about the theater, but the answer is a resounding maybe.
And Tommy, the next production of Hamilton you are directing is where?
That'll be the production that starts in Puerto Rico and then goes to San Francisco.
Okay. So is that next year?
That's it'll be the top of the year. So it'll be in January in Puerto Rico, and so Lynn's doing that, and then we'll go to San Francisco for the year for the rest of the year. In the meanwhile, you know, just continuing to cast the show and then try to make Sarah write another play.
Right.
All the usual stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And Gillian, what can Tommy do to finally impress you?
What can he do to finally impress me? Okay, he can get Hillary Mantel to come see our show.
Wow.
This is classic Gillian, by the way.
Hillary Mantel? What?
Yes.
Can we go in on this a little bit?
Yeah,
do you want to say the rest of the people?
Please.
Elaine May?
Elaine May
is listening to the stage.
I've given Tommy a list of people I would like to come see our play. So if he can get Elaine May, Hillary Mantel, Lori Siegel, Helen DeWitt, who else did I give you?
There was one other.
Hillary Mantel. I can't remember. That's my current list.
You yelled something at me yesterday, but I can't remember what it was. But I also want to say these were solicited. I don't want you to think that Gillian just runs around saying, invite these authors to the show.
Yes.
Right.
I did say, if you could have any six or seven people come see the show, and people that I have no opportunity to invite or cannot facilitate in any way. And she's like, great, here's a list. And I'm like, oh, you've done it. You're six for six. Although Elaine May, it feels like if there's one unicorn we could get.
You could maybe get Elaine May.
Maybe Elaine May.
Maybe. I know that she listens to this pod, so
yeah,
I know
that's really true.
But tell Hillary Mantel that...
This is Tamir to Gordon.
Hillary.
Hillary.
I'll do my best.
Hillary, I love your work. I'm reading your book backstage, and you're writing about the Marquis de Lafayette in the book I'm currently reading about the French Revolution, and I want you to know that the Public Theater is on Lafayette, which was named for him. I mention him in a scene in the play.
True.
And also, there's a restaurant called Lafayette where we could maybe have dinner together after the play.
Right across the street.
Yeah.
That's the best. I mean, Hillary, we'll see you there. So, look, you know, we should just make it like Guffman. There's going to be two tickets for Hillary at every performance, no matter what. And she'll either use them or Joel Grey will.
Yeah.
Apparently, Joel Grey just made the list.
Yeah, that's, all right.
I've met Joel Grey.
Oh, my God. Yeah. She really hates the theater.
I was directed by his son-in-law in a movie.
Oh, wow.
I got to meet Joel Grey. I can think of some more.
Great. We can do that, you know, on or off air, whatever's good for you.
Please keep us posted about all
great,
the people.
I will.
Yeah. All right.
Most of, you know, I'd have a much longer list, but a lot of them are sadly no longer with us. So I've tried to keep it to the living.
Thank you.
Well, thank you guys for being here. I really appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of the run, and I look forward to seeing the next show you work on together.
Great.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
That was actress Gillian Jacobs and director Thomas Kail on their latest project, Kings, now playing at the Public Theater through March 25th. On the next episode of Stagecraft, I'll be talking to Casey Nicolaw, Broadway's go-to guy for musical theater, and the director of The Book of Mormon, Aladdin, the upcoming musical adaptation of Mean Girls, and, in the fall, the new show The Prom. Until then, see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.